deep inside your radio.
Okay, that's a good way to start. Hello, everybody. It must be radio, huh? Ladies and gentlemen, I am... let me just tell you, if I say that last night I was in a room and on one side of the room was General President Pervez Musharraf, and on the other side of the room was Katie Couric, you may not know where I am, but I bet you know how I felt. Musharraf, first, he had a conversation earlier in the afternoon with the editor of a distinguished editor, publisher, chief executive of a major magazine. No, not Popular Mechanics, but another magazine that's still publishing. And they got into it was about a half hour conversation. And at one point, the magazine guy said, "Well, you had a conversation with President Ahmadinejad back in 2006 when you were still president, didn't you?" And President Musharraf said, "Yeah, we did." And we talked about his nuclear ambitions. And the interviewer said, "Did you suggest anything in that regard?" And he said, "Yeah, I was trying to convince him to be more on the conciliatory track and less on the confrontational track." And he spoke with an even better accent, I might point out, even more convincing. And not once in that conversation, given the topic, President Musharraf, President Ahmadinejad, nuclear capabilities, did the name A.Q. Khan come up. For late arriving listeners, A.Q. Khan, the father of the Pakistani nuclear bomb, sold nuclear information and materials to, among other countries, North Korea, Libya, and Iran. He's been under house arrest or some kind of thing ever since. I think he's not under house arrest anymore. But the Pakistani government has always insisted, yes, say it with me now, bad apple, rogue operator. You know the drill. Name never came up. As for Katie Couric, the good news is she did not say, "Harry Shearer, I'm going to get you," last night. The bad news is she did not say, "Harry Shearer, I'm not going to get you." So, really, we don't know. What the frack, ladies and gentlemen, what the frack? Dateline Pittsburgh. Three northeastern Pennsylvania families have reached $1.5 million settlement with a gas drilling company over contaminated water wells. How could that possibly have happened? The agreement provides little comfort to Jared McMicken, one of the members of one of the families, since his drinking water was ruined by nearby drilling and his family now must move. "We lost our house. We're not going to get out of it what we put into it," he said. "We have a bunch of people who have to leave their homes." The dispute with Oklahoma-based Chesapeake Energy, sure, there's a Chesapeake something in Oklahoma, began in 2010 in a community about 150 miles northwest of Philadelphia. The families insisted that any settlement in the case be made public. Lucky they weren't dealing with News Corporation. This is the first case involving pollution in the Marcellus Shale region, where the settlement terms were publicly disclosed. There have been other settlements. They have been sealed for your protection, ladies and gentlemen. As you know, the Marcellus Shale is a gas-rich rock formation thousands of feet under large parts of Pennsylvania, New York, Ohio, and West Virginia over the past 5 years. The gas has been made accessible, leading to a boom in production, jobs, and profits, and a drop in natural gas prices. Chesapeake says it believes there is no permanent damage to the properties and that other water wells in the area showed natural contamination before drilling began. The homeowner in question, McMicken, disputes that, saying his water and that of his neighbors was fine before the drilling. Last year, the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection fined Chesapeake just over $1 million for contaminating the water supplies of 16 families in the area, including those in the lawsuit. A transcript of expert testimony in the settlement showed that experts from the Department of Environmental Protection agreed that faulty cement casings on the wells allowed gas and other substances to migrate from deep underground and pollute the water wells. Faulty cement casings, ladies and gentlemen, ring a bell with anybody? Like, remind you of BP, Deepwater Horizon? Huh? So in addition to lack of accountability, faulty cement casings is our current epidemic. But let us try, won't you? Sans the theme song of the United States Army Corps of Engineers, because we are pressed for time and we're short of air up here. The Army Corps of Engineers has restarted the process, you see. Restarted it for awarding a $700 million contract to design and build a permanent set of pump stations at the outfall canals in New Orleans. Corps officials said the contract could be awarded this fall, construction beginning soon after. Officials hope the project can be completed by the summer of 2016. And by hope, they mean you can't take this to the bank. Until then, the temporary pumps remain. More information about the temporary pumps and the problems they may have in the Big Uneasy, thanks to a whistleblower inside the Corps of Engineers. The restarting of the process refers to the Corps had let out a contract for these pumps last year, and the Government Accountability Office quashed the contract on grounds of both cronyism and other grounds. The winning bidder appealed to a federal court, which threw out the cronyism charge but accepted the other grounds. So that contract is gone. And just so you know, at June 1st, New Orleans entered the seventh year of using those questionable pumps, which, according to the Corps of Engineers, have a lifespan of 5 to 7 years. Authorities on the East Bank of New Orleans, which is where New Orleans is mainly, have raised troubling questions about several major segments of the Corps' nearly completed improvements. You know, those wonderful improvements you read about, heard about at the beginning of the month? Including concerns about erosion along new T-walls and potential bending of long square pilings used to steady those walls. A key concern is that scouring caused by repeated hurricanes could weaken a 23-mile stretch of levees topped with new T-walls in St. Bernard Parish, which is supposed to protect Chalmette and the Lower Ninth Ward. Uh-oh. Maybe don't buy that Lower Ninth Ward property just yet. And it's not just New Orleans. Dateline Boise, Idaho, where this show used to be heard, the Army Corps of Engineers has upgraded the safety rating of a major Columbia Basin dam without any major repairs or changes to the structure. Corps spokesman says the federal agency decided to change the rating of Dworshak Dam from unsafe to conditionally unsafe after further study of the risks. Or maybe they just decided to try harder. Hello, welcome to the show.
Well, speaking of lying, well, I told a few. And they say that's not what Jesus would do. Well, I've been tempted, red, white, and blue. But you'll understand when you're in my shoes, I would just find my way. I don't believe I'd have made it up the mountain. I don't believe I'd have climbed so high. I don't believe I'd have made it up the mountain without the fire burning on my behind.
from Aspen, Colorado. Yes, you won. This is Harry Shearer welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, time to follow the dollar. While in this country, the Supreme Court decision involving the Affordable Care Act was the big news, understandably, of the week, in much of the rest of the world, big news was the admission by Barclays Bank, one of the major British banks, that traders there had engaged in a 4 or 5 year long bout of rigging the interest rate that is the basic reference rate for many of the financial transactions in the world. We're talking in the trillions of dollars. Most damning were the emails among traders that became public this week. "Done for you, big boy," read a message sent by one Barclays banker to one of the traders to ask, who asked him to fix a key lending rate artificially low. One of the purposes of this was to make, during the worst of the crisis, and assuming we're not still in the worst of the crisis, during that time, to make the banks look more financially sound than they might actually have been. Another of the emails: "Dude, I owe you big time. Come over one day after work. I'm opening up a bottle of Bollinger champagne." A trader from another firm emailed a banker at Barclays, showing his thanks for the rate set artificially low. Barclays has agreed to pay $453 million in fines to British and American regulators to settle its part of the investigation. By the way, other banks involved, major British banks and major, up to 20 international major banks. Thank God we don't have any of those in this country. Communications released by authorities showed Barclays traders calling each other superstar with little concern for covering their tracks as they urged colleagues responsible for submitting Barclays rates to try and influence final prices, such as, quote, "We really need a really low fix. It could potentially cost a fortune. Would really appreciate any help. Your annoying colleague again. Would love to get a high rate. A high 1 month. Also, if possible, a low 3 month. If possible, thanks." Traders made their requests in person, in email, and through electronic chats over an instant messaging system. Oh, on a few occasions, some traders even made entries in electronic calendars to remind themselves that requests to make of Barclays submitters to the people who set the rate, known as LIBOR, London Interbank Offering Rate, the next day. The traders were barking orders like they were at a fast food drive-thru, and the submitters were so accommodating they might as well have said, "Do you want fries with that?" said a commissioner at the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which led the settlement agreement. Barclays was not alone in all this, as indicated. A senior Barclays treasury manager called the British Bankers Association and warned them that rates were not accurate, but that Barclays was not the worst offender. Quote the Barclays senior treasury manager, "We're clean, but we're dirty clean rather than clean clean," said the representative of the British Bankers Association. Quote, "Nobody's clean clean." The Bank for International Settlements, which acts as a bank for the world's central banks, said, quote, "The financial sector needs to recognize losses and recapitalize." This is an outfit located in Basel. You want tomatoes with that? No. In Switzerland. "As we have urged in previous reports," the bank said, "banks must adjust balance sheets to accurately reflect the value of assets," unquote. That's banker talk for banks like those in this country are still valuing homes for which they have mortgages, first or second mortgages, at a rate higher than the market says they're worth. Uh-oh. The quote, "The challenge is to provide incentives for banks and other credit suppliers to recognize losses fully and write down debt," said the International Bank. The board of the Bank of International Settlements includes Ben Bernanke of the Federal Reserve, although he hasn't said that publicly in this country about our banks. I'm sure he has his reasons. Though, the head of the central bank in Britain has spoken out publicly this week. Mervyn King, head of the Bank of England, didn't talk like a head of the Federal Reserve. You can actually understand what he was saying.
There must be many people who work in the banking industry today who know that they are honest, hardworking, and feel that they've been let down by some of their colleagues and indeed their leaders. What I hope is that everyone now understands that something went very wrong with the UK banking industry and we need to put it right. That goes to both the question of culture in the banking industry and to the structure of the banking industry, from excessive levels of compensation to shoddy treatment of customers to a deceitful manipulation of one of the most important interest rates, and now this morning to news of yet another mis-selling scandal, we can see that we need a real change in the culture of the industry. And that will require two things. One is leadership of an unusually high order and changes to the structure of the industry. On the former, that's for another day and another place. But on the latter, the structure of the industry, we can see what has gone wrong. The idea that the culture of investment banking is the same as the culture of basic banking, I've been arguing for several years, and I think it's very clear now that those two cultures are completely different and they need to be separated.
The culture of the retail banking is they listen to Kenny Chesney, and the culture of the investment banking is they listen to Grand Opera. I guess that's what he's saying. Anyway, that's Mervyn King of the Bank of England. And when he refers to mis-selling, I think we talked about it. There's only one of me. I talked about last week's broadcast report that British banks were selling very sophisticated interest rate hedging, quote, products, unquote, to small businesses. And they got burned when interest rates took a dive because they were supposed to be hedging against rising interest rates. Something that's happened in this country to many municipalities. Follow the dollar, ladies and gentlemen. We continue to do that, even though it's hard to understand. Got to try. Let us try. Don't you think? It is a copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. And now, news from outside the bubble. From Asia Times. In 2012, the Pentagon has ramped up its anti-drug operations in Honduras, working out of forward operating base Mocoron and other remote camps. The U.S. military is supporting Honduran operations by way of the methods honed in Iraq and Afghanistan. U.S. forces have taken part in joint operations with Honduran troops. In an operation dubbed Beyond the Horizon 2012, Green Berets have been assisting Honduran special ops forces in anti-smuggling operations. And a Drug Enforcement Administration foreign deployed advisory support team, originally created to disrupt the poppy trade in Afghanistan, good work, boys, on that, has joined forces with Honduras Tactical Response Team, that country's most elite counter-narcotics unit. Recently, DEA agents flying in an American helicopter were involved in an aerial attack on civilians that killed two men and two pregnant women in the remote Mosquito Coast region. The war on drugs is a war. Also from Asia Times, Pakistan's efforts to contain polio in areas bordering Afghanistan may have been set back following the conviction of a doctor who allegedly ran a fake vaccine program to locate Osama bin Laden. Dr. Shakil Afridi, who was sentenced to 30 years in prison last month on charges of treason, actually in May, is said to have helped the CIA track down bin Laden by collecting DNA samples from selected residents in Abbottabad. Medicine Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, had then warned that the CIA's use of a vaccination program as a cover to spy on bin Laden threatened immunization work around the world. Afridi's role appears to have exacerbated suspicions among people in the tribal areas that polio vaccinations are part of a U.S. conspiracy to render their children infertile. The problem of refusing vaccination is not new, but Afridi's fake vaccination campaign has proved to be a setback to our efforts to popularize immunization, according to Dr. Rakhmanul Khan, a polio officer in the tribal area. From the Irish Times, in a final vote of no confidence, Ireland's ill-fated electronic voting machines are headed, ladies and gentlemen, to the scrap heap. A firm based in Offaly, it's Offaly, KMK Metals Recycling was declared the government's preferred bidder to crush and recycle the machines. The company paid about $100,000 for the machines. They cost Ireland about $80 million. Minister for the Environment, Phil Hogan, said he was glad to bring this sorry episode to a conclusion on behalf of the taxpayer. From the outset, this project was ill-conceived, he said, and poorly delivered by my political predecessors. A scandalous waste of public money, he said. By the way, speaking of quotes, apropos of the Barclays Bank thing, a partner in the British coalition government, Vince Cable, today described the banking industry as, quote, a cesspit. But now back to Ireland. The equipment includes 7,500 electronic voting machines. They're going to be scrapped. They were tried in a number of constituencies during the 2002 general election in Ireland, and later the same year in seven referendums in seven constituencies. Planned to roll out the machines nationally in 2004 were abandoned by the government after a report from an independent commission raised issues about their reliability. Amid mounting concerns over their reliability and storage costs, the idea of electronic voting was finally scrapped in 2009. But don't get me wrong, that's just Ireland. What do they know, you know? You know that the United States government already has 16 intelligence agencies. We now have 17. In April, Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta announced the creation of a new espionage agency within the Pentagon. Leon Panetta used to run the CIA. He's now Secretary of Defense. He missed intel, although the Pentagon already has at least three that I know of. And what do I know? Anyway, this one's called the Defense Clandestine Service. According to the Washington Post, its aim is to expand the military's espionage efforts beyond war zones, like, say, your house. They didn't say that. But they could have. And they might still. News from outside the bottle. I'm going to just walk away from the microphone for a moment and try to pronounce the word bubble. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, the President's Weekly Address. And now, the President Weekly.
This week, the Supreme Court gave an early 4th of July surprise to the American people when a majority of the justices upheld the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. Now, of course, as somebody who used to teach constitutional law, I wasn't surprised. After all, the only laws or executive orders I might sign that might not be constitutional are kept secret. So we have a lot of parts of the Affordable Care Act to celebrate this Independence Day. And since most of them won't go into effect until at least 2014, I thought I'd spend a few minutes reminding you of what you might soon be grateful for. For one thing, millions of Americans who today can't afford health insurance will soon be covered by expanded state Medicaid plans, unless the states decide not to expand their plans, which we very much hope they won't decide not to do. Millions of others will be able to choose their insurance plans from exchanges set up by the states, unless the states decide not to set up the exchanges, in which case we'll do it for them. Unless the Supreme Court in a future case decides we can't do that, which we very much hope they won't decide. If you've got a youngster under 26, you'll continue to have him or her covered by your health plan unless your insurance company rewrites your policy to exclude dependents, which, of course, we really, really hope they won't do. And if you have a pre-existing condition, you'll continue to enjoy your freedom from being discriminated against by insurance companies unless, to compensate themselves for covering you, they raise premiums for everybody else, which we kind of know they will do, in which case we hope we can figure out a fix later on. You know, as I'm sure our opponents will remind you along the way this year, there was a time when I wasn't convinced the individual mandate was a good idea. So we didn't promise you that during the 2008 campaign. But in a larger sense, the victory we enjoyed this week means that we've delivered exactly what we did promise during that campaign year. Hope. Have a great 4th of July.
Funds for this broadcast came from the Dick and Dorothy Fromson Foundation for live coverage of pre-taped speeches. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
And now news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersole, Jr. The organizers of the London Olympics are refusing to pay the musicians they're asking to perform at the Games, according to Corporate Watch. We know about this from the opening ceremony discussed in this program earlier this year. Professional musicians approached by the London Organizing Committee have been told the policy is not to pay artists and that they should do it for the exposure. In addition to the opening and closing ceremonies, the organizing committee, LOCOG, is contracting professional musicians to provide entertainment and atmosphere at sporting events during the games themselves. One musician in a band asked by LOCOG to perform at various venues said, quote, they said they were really keen for us to play on major stages at different events. We quoted our normal fees. After months of meetings, they offered us a raft of gigs, but said it was LOCOG's policy not to pay any musicians for performing. Another who wishes to remain anonymous said LOCOG had asked them to sign contracts, agreeing to be volunteers, so they'd be under no obligation to pay them. The LOCOG email, seen by Corporate Watch, says the policy not to pay musicians is being implemented across the board. A LOCOG spokesperson said he didn't think there was a set policy, but as far as he knew, artists would not be paid and would be doing it for the publicity. The Musicians Union says they're going to investigate. If it turns out to be true, a union spokesperson said, it flies in the face of assurances we have been given regarding the engaging of musicians during games time. It would also appear to be a breach of the principles of cooperation that LOCOG agreed with the trade unions. LOCOG chair Sebastian Coe has promised to place a high priority on environmental, social, and ethical issues when securing goods and services. Mayor of London, Bojo, joined Lord Coe, head of LOCOG, on Tower Bridge to mark the final countdown. They're dangling a set of Olympic rings from Tower Bridge in a bid to excite and inspire Londoners. Asked to explain their significance,
Boris Johnson, the mayor of London, Bojo I call him, quoted Baron Pierre de Coubertin, the father of the modern games, suggesting the five interlaced rings represented, quote, athleticism, sportsmanship, exertion, poverty, and chastity, unquote. He got them wrong. They, five multicolored rings didn't appear until 1914. They appear to represent the five continents of the world united by the Olympics rather than poverty and chastity. The 2012 Summer Games are on course to be the most over-budget games for 16 years after organizers failed to forecast demands for security and private investment, according to the Oxford University. The sports-related expense of hosting in the British capital is likely to cost more than twice the original estimate. That's the most since the 1996 Summer Games in Atlanta, where costs overran by 147%. The Olympics. They're a movement. And we all need them. Every day. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of our friend the atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet. Save, save, too safe to meet.
Addie?
Yeah?
How are you doing with the altitude?
I'm screwed. Totally screwed. I fell in some booze last night.
Oh, wow. That is bad. You got to watch that.
I know. Now.
Addie, a little addled.
I don't appreciate that.
I know you don't. I didn't appreciate saying it. Dateline Yakima, Washington. Addie the Atom, ladies and gentlemen. Dateline Yakima, Washington, a new cost estimate and construction schedule for a massive waste plant being built at the nation's most contaminated nuclear site. It's going to be delayed at least a year. Almost as if the Corps of Engineers was working on it, as workers try to resolve serious technical problems raised by whistleblowers about design and safety. Almost as if the Corps of Engineers did it. That's according to the U.S. Department of Energy. The announcement seemed, this is at Hanford, the huge mess up in Washington State. The announcement seemed certain to spark new fears about the long-term viability of the project that has already been the subject of numerous lawsuits, remains a top priority of Washington and Oregon, despite its ballooning budget. Almost as if it's the Olympics, and delays. The $12.3 billion waste treatment plant is currently scheduled to begin operating. This is nuclear waste, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks for mentioning that.
Yeah, I wanted to give you the plug. It's scheduled to begin operating in 2019 under a consent decree with Washington State, the EPA, and the Energy Department. Those must be some fun negotiations among those three. The plant, long considered the cornerstone of the nuclear cleanup at Hanford, is being built to convert highly radioactive and toxic waste into a stable glass form for permanent disposal underground, where no one would ever look for radioactive glass. However, several workers have raised concerns about safety, particularly about erosion and corrosion, the two Rosen brothers, in tanks and piping inside the plant. The issues are significant because the problem areas are inside so-called black cells. High radioactivity levels will make the areas inaccessible for maintenance and repairs after the plant begins operating. You can never go into a black cell. The Energy Department.
You're just being provocative.
I hope. The Energy Department and its contractor, hired to build the plant, Bechtel, have been working to develop a new price tag and construction schedule for the plant in light of those problems. But the Energy Department announced in a conference call the new estimates will be delayed at least a year as it embarks on additional tests to resolve the safety issues. The tests themselves are expected to cost tens of millions of dollars. I have no idea who's going to pay for that. Information gained from those tests could provide a higher level of confidence that the plan can perform as originally conceived for its 40-year life, said Dave Heisinger, senior advisor for the Office of Environmental Management. We're committed to ultimately bringing this facility online and having it operate in the long term, 40 years, in a safe and efficient manner, he said. He declined to speculate on how much more construction will cost or how long the plant will be delayed.
No one can know that. That's unknowable.
So you know the unknowable?
I know about the unknowable.
Okay. I guess the booze didn't...
No, it didn't.
Dateline, Japan. The highest level of radiation to date has been detected inside the number one reactor at the Fuke plant in Japan. Highest level of radiation to date. So they're on the upward side of the curve. Usually that's good. The plant's operator, TEPCO, said this week it used endoscopes, ouch, and dosimeters to examine the interior of the reactor. A record level of 10,300 millisieverts per hour was detected in the internal measurement, carried out for the first time since the accident a year and a half ago. So that's why it would be the highest. It's the only measurement they've done. The measurement was taken 20 centimeters above the surface of a contaminated water puddle in the reactor's suppression chamber. That sounds nice. That sounds like a nice place to be. The high level of radiation would be fatal for humans within 5 minutes. A measurement of 1,000 millisieverts per hour was detected about 4 meters above the water surface, which is 10 times higher than measured in the number 2 and number 3 reactors. TEPCO official Junichi Matsumoto said he expected that a higher level of radiation in number 1 was caused by more fuel rods melting down than in other reactors. He said robots would be used for damage assessment because it was unsafe for humans to work on the site. Boy, if the robots ever unionize, ladies and gentlemen, we're in a peck of trouble. Meanwhile, officials from the Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency apologized to Kawauchi Mayor Yuko Endo and communities around the plant for failing to release maps showing dangerous radiation areas. Residents of the village were forced to evacuate after the government designated 20-kilometer no-entry zones. The mayor said if the information were given to the village, people could have avoided evacuating directly into the areas where the radiation was going. He also said more than a year has passed since the accident, and the apology meant, quote, nothing.
He's bitter.
Yeah, I guess he is. Two prominent seismologists said this week that Japan is ignoring the safety lessons of the Fuke crisis, and they warned against restarting two reactors, as Japan plans to, this month, July.
I don't lie.
No, I said July. Japan has approved the restart of the two reactors at the Kansai Electric Power Plant northwest of Tokyo despite mass public opposition. They'll be the first to come back online after all reactors were shut down following the Fuke thing. Seismic modeling by Japan's nuclear regulator did not properly take into account active fault lines near the Ohi plant, a seismologist at Kobe University told reporters, Mr. Ishibashi. The stress tests and new safety guidelines for restarting nuclear power plants both allow for accidents at plants to occur. He said instead of making standards more strict, they both represent a severe setback in safety standards. Experts advising the nuclear industry had underestimated the seismic threat, said Dr. Watanabe, Dr. Mitsuhisa Watanabe, a tectonic geomorphology professor at Tokyo University. The expertise and neutrality of experts advising the Nuclear Safety Agency are highly questionable, Dr. Watanabe said.
I question him.
Wow. Good riposte. Addy, the Adam, ladies and gentlemen. Clean, safe, too cheap to even pay attention to. It is our friend, the Atom, and coming up this week, the 4th of July.
We came like babies from a home across the sea to see America and the people. Distant land to see America and the golden sun of freedom.
built it down to us in America. And people stood and stared. Loved us more than we had dared to in America.
It's a 2009 Sentra, and it's on fire.
Lives.
If I don't get that car by this evening, my child will be sitting in that school building completely alone.
Relationships.
Love. You wouldn't know love if it shot you in the head with its grease gun.
Stay tuned for a super trailer of the new dramatic series from Noah Sokin, The Lube Room. Meet the men and women from Oil Coast Station 3841 in Redondo Beach, California. Just an ordinary gas station with an ordinary lube room. Until you look inside, as only Noah Sokin can.
Look, Grady, I didn't spend a whole summer training you to have this happen.
Matt, it was an accident. I was recalibrating the diagnostics computer and
something went haywire in your own computer. This is summer, right?
Of course.
Yet you changed the oil in that Buick to winter weight, right? Let me tell you something, man. I didn't just fall into this lube room from outer space. I chose to be here. I knew there were cars that needed to be periodically lubricated, and I knew there were places that would do it faster and cheaper. In a jiffy, if you believe the ads. So, I had only one choice. I had to do it better. Maybe take a little longer. Maybe charge a little more. Maybe that's a choice you just don't want to make.
Matt, you don't live inside my head.
Thank God for that.
The Collins Volvo has to have its alternator replaced and be absolutely out of here by 4.
Not gonna happen. Those alternators have been on back order since before Chevron bought Texaco.
Dr. Rednick's Audi is back in.
There's nothing wrong with it.
Somebody's gonna have to tell that to Dr. Rednick.
Well, hey, you trying to kill us, man?
There are easier ways than running you over at 5 miles an hour with a late model Taurus.
What else you got?
A roaring migraine. You?
A throbbing Woody.
I'm pushing it as hard as I can.
Then maybe that's a signal you should stop pushing it.
Hey, man. Get off my back. This is the way we always did it at Sears.
Earth to Grady. This isn't Sears.
Hey, look, Matt. I never wanted to come back and run this place.
You know, the L.A. Phil has a violin section just a phone call away. Might juice the pathos content just a little bit.
Stop it. When my dad died, it was accept the buyout from Citgo
Or tuck your tail neatly between your legs and come back to your friendly neighborhood tormentor.
You know damn well if Citgo wasn't owned by Hugo Chavez, I wouldn't be here.
Look, princess, I'm not standing in the middle of this lube room with my hands dirtier than a Chicago alderman's because my rich daddy owned a string of oil co stations.
No, you're here because you drank too much, too early, too often to keep the GM job. Or do I have you confused with some other Matt Clayman?
Look, man, I don't have time for this. Dr. Goldbrecht is expecting his Maserati to be delivered half an hour ago.
Yes, but Citgo is prepared to make a very generous increase in our offer.
Do I look like I'm either dumb enough or rich enough to own this place?
But Signora Tricia, she listens to you, no? Get out of my loop, bae. Coming in July, a new kind of drama from the same kind of writer. Lube Room. Because oil and people don't mix.
You can't handle the grease.
The Lube Room. Exclusively on HBO Minus, the premium pay service you watch only on your phone. Order now.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Willow Smith. Know her? It's Will Smith's daughter. She's apologized for posting a photo on Instagram that made it seem that she'd gotten her tongue pierced. The 11-year-old singer received instant criticism from fans and the media after posting a pic earlier last month in which she and a friend appear to show off their tongue piercings, but Willow has since issued an apology writing, "It's fake. Sorry." A source says the so-called piercing is, in fact, just a magnet. A Nashville man was booted from a Kenny Chesney concert last week for looking too much like Kenny Chesney. Kenny Chesney's label and promoter, Sony Label, has apologized. So don't look too much like Kenny Chesney, ladies and gentlemen. Really, seriously. In a closed-door House GOP meeting this week, Indiana congressman and gubernatorial candidate Mike Pence likened the Supreme Court's ruling upholding health care law to the 9/11 terrorist attacks, according to several sources present. He immediately apologized. Quote, "My remarks at the Republican conference following the Supreme Court decision were thoughtless. I certainly did not intend to minimize any tragedy our nation has faced, and I apologized." "And I apologize," he said to Politico. Unless Bill Burton says he didn't. Peter Madoff, brother of shamed U.S. financier Bernie Madoff, pleaded guilty this week to helping cook the books of the world's biggest ever Ponzi scheme, accepted a 10-year prison term. Quote, "I apologize to the people I hurt and to my family," 66-year-old Madoff told a packed Manhattan courtroom after confessing to tax fraud and falsifying documents on behalf of his brother, who's already behind bars. Madoff spoke clearly during his statement, but broke down when he apologized toward the end and said he was initially shocked and horrified by his brother's fraud. "Until December 2008, I never suspected my brother stole from anyone. I lost my reputation. I accept my responsibility for what I've done," he added. "I knew my conduct was wrong." Sumitomo Mitsui Financial Group President Koichi Miyata apologized to shareholders following the arrest of a former brokerage unit executive suspected of insider trading. Facebook apologized this week to users and admitted it could have done a better job in explaining and notifying users of changes made to its email display platform. The issues began when Facebook added addresses hosted by Facebook to users' contact information without first alerting users to the change. How very like Facebook. Dateline Melbourne, Australia. Church, known for its charity work, has apologized after one of its leading Australian officials said homosexuals deserved to die. Speaking to gay radio station Joy FM, the Salvation Army's Victorian spokesman, Major Andrew Crabe, repeatedly endorsed a Bible passage that said being gay was evil and punishable by death. Well, that's part of our belief system, he said. The church has sincerely apologized. Spokesman Major Bruce Harmer said the comments were extremely regrettable and the Salvation Army members did not believe and would never endorse a view that homosexual activity should result in any form of physical punishment. Really? A quote, the Salvation Army acknowledges that the interview has led us to a serious misunderstanding of our teaching, he said. Merrimack, New Hampshire Tea Party founder Mike Malzone, a former town councillor, removed a statement posted on the Tea Party's Facebook page condemning the Supreme Court justices who upheld the Affordable Care Act. It's been replaced by an apology and a retraction. I am publicly retracting the statements I made. I'm retracting them because they not reflect my true feelings about the justices. They were made in the heat of the moment, fueled by anger and frustration, he said. I vented my anger without thinking the result were hurtful remarks. My behavior was wrong and inexcusable. I take 100% responsibility for my actions. I deeply regret my actions will be used to attack individuals. This is my last statement on the issue. I will move forward. Sounds like the president. He had originally said in a Facebook post reacting to the Supreme Court ruling, I hope the Supreme Court justices get colon cancer, unquote. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. You can bet it's a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, it has been a thrill to be here at Aspen Public Radio this week.
I'd hate to call you a liar, but I don't believe you.
Rupert, you... Anyway, that does conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ The Planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived whenever you want it. HarryShearer.com and KCRW.com. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com and available as a free podcast through KCRW.com. And it would be just like asking Pervez Musharraf about AQ Con when you get the chance. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you already? Thank you very much. Thanks to the folks here at KAGX in Aspen who don't carry this broadcast for helping with today's broadcast. And thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. And a tip of the show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. The music heard here on the playlists And the email address for this broadcast available at harryshearer.com. This broadcast is on Twitter at The Harry Shearer. Join the more than 64,000 followers. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. I'm doing the big skedaddle. So, local stations, if you want to talk over the last minute of music, feel free. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.